morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, March 11th, 2010, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web, and this is Air Cascadia. Long-run content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm William Delta.
The Obama administration is raising concerns about a compromise bill for managing national forests east of the Cascades.
March 4th marked a shift in the winds at colleges and universities across the nation. We're out of the doldrums.
And here comes another opportunity to remind the powers that be that the Columbia River crossing is one bridge you can't cross twice.
Portland area weather today, rain, high near 52. Tonight, rain, low around 46. And then rain and showers through Saturday, and then partly sunny the beginning of next week.
First headlines from around Cascadia, but before that, a correction. Yesterday, I read a piece that I had taken from a generally reliable local print source. I snatched facts too quickly without looking carefully at that, and with the result that I'm reading you this today. Margaret Carter left the Oregon Senate last summer to take a state job. Chip Shields was appointed to her position, District 22, and served with distinction during the February 2010 session. I apparently said on the air that she is now leaving to take a state job. Jackie Winters, a female, not he, and I believe I did say he. I know Jackie Winters is not I know Jackie Winters is female. And I'm not sure how that got into the mix, nonetheless. Jackie Winters is not the only African-American serving in the state legislature. And Lou Frederick, who is black, was appointed to replace Chip Shields, and he represents District 43, served with distinction during the February 2010 session. Hope that clears everything up for you. In the last couple of months, there have been some significant developments regarding the Columbia River crossing. Back in January, elected officials on the Project Sponsors Council wrote a letter to Oregon Governor Kulongoski and Washington Governor Chris Gregoire saying that, quote, "We believe that cost, physical, and environmental elements of the project as currently proposed impose unacceptable impacts on our communities." Those impacts are what we're going to talk about today. My guest is David Osborne with the Anti-CRC Coalition. Thanks so much for being with us today, David.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk first about the unacceptable impacts?
Yeah, I think that the bridge does a variety of things. In terms of the environment, it's going to increase greenhouse gases, contrary to a lot of what is said at some of these Project Sponsors Council meetings. It's going to put a lot of pollutants into the air, which are already at unacceptable levels along the I-5 corridor there and in other parts of the city. It's going to increase a type of urban sprawl that we see in Clark County, for example, that does not create the kind of more livable, community-oriented type of urban development that we want in this region. And, I mean, those are a couple to start with, I suppose.
So, what do we think about a region, an area, Cascadia, for example? We have to consider the carrying capacity of the environment. Where would you say we are in terms of carrying capacity? Can we really reasonably sustain more growth of the sort that we have seen in past decades?
Well, I think that in a lot of ways, no. I mean, to expect us to be able to continue to grow exponentially within a finite system is pretty unreasonable. And I think that in terms of carrying capacity, I do believe it comes down to a lot about how we choose to live. I think that currently we consume quite a bit here in this region, and certainly at these consumption levels, we're already importing quite a significant amount of resources from other places. And so, at the consumption, I think that we need a kind of shift in how we orient ourselves and away from materialist kind of values.
Talk a little bit, too, because tomorrow there's the Project Sponsors Council meeting is coming up. And, of course, we want people to turn out for that and express their views on the Columbia River crossing. Can you tell everyone a little bit about that?
Yeah, we would really encourage people to come out and join us. You read the quote that the elected officials on the Project Sponsors Council issued to the two governors back in January. In February, last month, the governors responded to that, saying basically that we value your advisory role on this project, but we believe that this project must move forward without delay, basically saying that both the input from our local elected officials and our public input is not valued by them, and that they're going to continue to move this project forward over those concerns. And this is despite assurances that were given to the Portland City Council by the ODOT director and also the chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission back in the numerous hearings that happened in 2008 and 2009. They said that if local elected officials decided that this was not a project that they wanted to go forward, they would not move forward over the objections of those local elected officials. Now we have that case occurring, and the governors are telling us that they're going to move forward despite that. So we'd encourage folks to come out and join us at 9:30. We're going to be there. The meeting starts at 10, but we're going to be there to show them that we in this region are against this project and that we make the decisions and that this project should not move forward.
And they seem to be in a very big rush, which that in itself would cause eyebrows to be raised. My guest has been David Osborne with the Anti-CRC Coalition. Again, thank you so much for that, David. And we'll post the information on the Cascadia section of the KBOO website so that you can make sure to plan on being there.
Great, thanks.
The old canary in the coal mine adage gathers fresh irony in Oregon. We have an increasing number of young children identified as having developmental delays. And they'll need more help as they progress up the learning ladder. In Multnomah County alone, there's been a huge one-year surge. Of course, it costs money to reach these children and their families earlier with specialized help, but addressing the root of the problem would protect children and save the state millions, if not billions, of dollars over the long term. It's long past time we looked at environmental factors that are a major contributor to the problem.
Yeah, it would be good to think that we were wise enough to plan ahead. Children shouldn't have to suffer these kind of setbacks unnecessarily because our levels of consumption demand that we increasingly pollute our own habitat. There was an article recently in Counterpunch. The author writes, March 4th was historic. It'll be remembered as the day that people began to fight back against the destruction of public education. The student and teacher-led offensive took place in cities across the country. Teachers, students, and school workers demonstrated and marched, showcasing the aggressive methods of the struggle. The writer of those words is Seamus Cook, my guest this morning. Good morning, Seamus. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure.
This is a terrific article. I've for a long time had concerns about the privatization of education. When we say that, when we talk about the privatization of education, what are we really talking about? What do we mean?
Well, we're talking about a field once held to be and held a field once in the common areas controlled by the people for the people's benefit, and it is now being put forth for private profit.
And there's a danger right there. We've seen the privatization creeping into every aspect of life in this country. And again, the Tea Party groups across the country seem to be advocating further privatization, and their basic premise is that government has no other function other than war, actually. So talk more about in your article, you write that Bush's plan further undermined public education. Schools were labeled as failures, and teachers were targeted as incompetent. How does Obama's approach to education and the potential for privatization, how does his approach differ?
Well, there's not much difference at all, really. The only difference is that Obama is expanding Bush's policy. He's making it more explicit. His plan demands that in order to receive these special funds that he has in his Race for the Top program, schools must be shut down, that he labels as failing. And a failing school is almost always a poor school in a poor neighborhood that's underfunded. It also demands that teachers who are bad teachers, that he calls bad teachers, and these are teachers, of course, who are work for poor schools. So students in poor schools, if they have poor test scores, then the teachers are bad teachers. And these teachers, under Obama's plan, must be fired. And this is what he calls progress. And it's really dangerous.
Speaking of course, of teachers, there are going to be serious labor questions as we wade into these murky waters. Teachers are notoriously overworked and underpaid. How would privatization affect the teachers' labor protections?
Well, the schools that have been opened already as charter schools, as private schools, they are very anti-union. That's kind of one of the core premise of the whole plan, is teachers make too much money, they say. They make a living wage, and that has to be stopped. And so these new charter schools, the teachers are underpaid. Most of them are underqualified, the ones who are not rehired in charter schools. And that does that also brings up the question of these school closures that Obama also advocates. These closures are and school teacher firings, they're breaking contracts that teachers have in the unions, and that sets a dangerous precedent for anybody in the union.
You write in the article, to make clear that the war on education is just beginning, Obama revealed that race to the top is only in its first stage, and that schools that don't win by failing to close enough schools or firing enough teachers will have more chances in the future. That sounds rather grim. Just in closing, can you talk just a little bit about what people can do? I mean, one of the tactics of the right has been to get as many people on school boards as they possibly can. What sort of tactics or strategies do you see as most effective in confronting the privatization of our schools?
Well, step one has to be people have to be conscious of this, and there's been very little talk about this. So teachers have to understand what's going on, and they have to work in the unions to fight this, because a lot of unions right now have been very quiet about this. The labor leaders of the teachers' unions at the very top are kind of cozy with Obama, so they don't want to really educate about this topic. So I think right now the teachers have to be mobilized, students have to be mobilized, and they can work together, they can demonstrate. There needs to be some activity, because right now there's very little. There's been some activity in California and elsewhere about colleges, which is important, and that's a big piece of the puzzle. But when it comes down to, you know, K through 12 education, there's been very little work on this. So right now it's just about getting people aware of this really monstrous attack that's happening.
Thanks so much for that. My guest has been Seamus Cook, a social service worker, trade unionist, and writer for Workers' Action. And I would definitely recommend this article that appeared recently in Counterpunch, The Fight to Save Public Education. Thanks again, Seamus.
Thanks, Chris.
This from Larry Bradshaw, posted on Indy Media. In a stunning upset, union reformers in Service Employees International Union, SEI Local 1021, swept to victory in their local's first ever elections, an outcome that will rattle the top leaders of the 2 million member union. The reformers in Local 1021 were expected to do well, given the Northern California's local's poor performance defending jobs and public services, and local officials' seeming inability to resist concessions. Even so, the reform slate, calling itself Change 1021, surpassed everyone's expectations by winning 26 of the 28 positions it contested. The reform slate won all the officer positions, most of the locals' industry and committee chairs, and secured a majority on the executive board.
Next time you find yourself in court, sitting on the bench, waiting for your court-appointed attorney, you might find yourself sitting right next to none other than Bill Sizemore. Yep, Bill Sizemore says that he is completely broke. Maybe his wife bought a new set of golf clubs. We don't know. But we do know that the conservative political activist claims that he barely has $100 in the bank, is working for $10 an hour planting trees and clearing brush.
It all started with a plan brokered by Senator Ron Wyden intended to limit old-growth logging, protect watersheds, increase thinning, and end eastern Oregon forest disputes. It came after months of negotiations between environmental groups and timber industry representatives. Now the Obama administration is raising concerns about a compromise bill for managing national forests east of the Cascades. At issue is the bill's mandate to thin 300,000 acres in the next 3 years. The concern is that this may generate unrealistic expectations in timber towns. The 80,000 acres of thinning the bill calls for next fiscal year would double the current levels.
Agribusiness, megastores, and gigasite converge. Gigasite, of course, would be the unnatural abundance of ways that the government has of looking into what we civilians are up to. The nut of it is this. Health department investigators use consumer tracking technology in the form of shopper cards to trace the source of a salmonella outbreak. If this was a disaster movie, here's the spoiler. It was the salami. But when you have meat from hundreds of massive factory farms sold in enormous nationwide chain stores, there's no avoiding cases of poisoning because the scale of the problem, new forms of surveillance are spawned. Nothing about the chain of events is healthy, and all of it is entirely within our power as consumers to put an end to. All it would take is the will to change behaviors.
And the Oregon's forests are under siege, and it's not just the timber industry. For one property owner, this is the third year that his carefully managed woodland east of Florence has been ravaged by trespassing truffle hunters. They destroy fragile forest substory and soil, expose roots, trample everything in their path, and scatter trash. They're after truffles, worth $80 to $100 a pound wholesale. The Corvallis-based North American Truffling Society provides tips on how legitimate truffle hunters can minimize disturbance to the environment. But when a fast buck's on the hoof, habitat be damned. Anyway, you can call the forestry department and make them earn their own fast bucks.
Well, icebreakers are back. After a $62 million overhaul, the Coast Guard will have its third icebreaker back in service in 2013. Admiral Tad Allen is absolutely disingenuous about it. He says the ships fill a critical need as the fleet takes on new responsibilities beyond simply crushing ice. And what might those new responsibilities consist of? With the ice caps melting and new frontiers in mineral oil and natural gas exploration opening up, the prize goes to the first icebreaker to strike gold.
This has been Air Cascadia for Thursday, March 11, 2010. Engineering is Emily Young. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Chris Andre is the producer. I'm Liam Delta.
You've been listening to News and Comment from Air Cascadia on KBOO, your community radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, kboo.fm on the web. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members.
Coming up next, Flashpoints. Nora Barrows-Friedman on more illegal settlements in the West Bank. And Catherine Austin Fitz on community business.
Thanks for listening, thanks for your support, and have a good day.
On Flashpoints, Nora Barrows-Friedman reports from the occupied West Bank on the accelerated building of illegal Jewish settlements far beyond what was announced by Israelis, and our weekly segment on community business with Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Joseph Biden, the U.S. Vice President, has said that Israel's decision to expand settlement activity in occupied East Jerusalem undermines the trust needed for peace talks. The news that Israel planned to build 1,600 new housing units came the same day Biden was in Israel to emphasize the U.S. president's commitment to Israel's security in the face of a possible Iranian nuclear threat. Of course, the article says nothing about the fact that Israel is a nuclear renegade with 200 weapons that could blow the Middle East off the face of the earth. But joining us to talk about the settlements and nuclear in the Middle East is our own Nora Barros-Friedman. She's a senior producer for this show called Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Nora, welcome back to Flashpoints. Your response to Joe Biden and the fact that Israel gave the peace talks an immediate slap in the face by announcing they will continue to build.
Well, it's not the peace talks that really were given a slap in the face. It's international law and people's human rights that were given another slap in the face. And it's not just today that, that Israel announced that they're building 1,600 units. It's not like they weren't building them all over the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem anyway, on every day here in Palestine. It's very nice of Joe Biden to come here and shake hands with the Quisling PA president, Mahmoud Abbas, and say some very stern-sounding words against Israeli policy in occupied East Jerusalem in terms of building these settlement colonies. But really, you know, these words mean nothing, because he's going to go back to the United States and he's going to sign another check to the Israeli government for another $3 to $6 billion a year to finance this illegal occupation, this illegal takeover of Palestinian lands and neighborhoods in Jerusalem and all over the West Bank. Really, these words mean nothing, and it's not lost on the Palestinians here.
Nora, you spent some time, actually, I believe it was today, inside a Jewish, an illegal Jewish settlement, and you confirmed that this was not a new announcement for a new building. Talk about what happened. Where were you?
Well, I'm not going to reveal the name of this settlement colony. I'm doing a little bit of research into, you know, really what's actually going on. You know, when we read these headlines, these settlement colonies, you know, Netanyahu says that he's going to slow the building or he's going to stop building and all of these, you know, kind of flashy headlines. We all know that he has no interest in doing so. We all know that these settlement colonies all over the East Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank are still being built hour by hour. And so I went into one today and poked around a little bit and you know, saw the construction workers, Palestinian construction workers, who are building these settlement colonies against international law, financed by the United States and European countries. They have Palestinian laborers who can't find work anywhere in the West Bank or in Jerusalem coming to build these settlement colonies. And they are expanding hour by hour. Cranes were working. There were bulldozers. There are entirely new areas of this colony that weren't there, you know, last time I was here. And, you know, I went into the real estate office. There are many of them. I went into there and talked with the real estate agent, and she assured me that yes, these neighborhoods were continuing to be built. And I asked, you know, wow, well, how many people do you expect to be living here in the next 6 to 12 months? And she said, oh, thousands, tens of thousands of people. We're trying to get a lot of people here. It's a fantastic place to live. We'll give you a garden. We'll give you a balcony. There's private security. She actually said to me, I asked, you know, well, what happens if an Arab, you have to use the term Arab because Palestinian is too political, you know, and I didn't want to give myself away. So I said, well, what happens if an Arab, you know, comes into the settlement? Tell me about the security issue here. And she said, oh, you know, living here, you don't see Arabs. This is one of the best things about living here. People are encouraged to be openly racist here. People are encouraged to keep building these settlement colonies because they know that the current administration and the Palestinian Authority, both backed by the current United States administration, will not step on this policy. They are continuing to support the illegal takeover, the illegal land grab, the illegal colonization of Palestine. And in occupied East Jerusalem, this is just one more instance of one more settlement colony being built on Palestinian land illegally.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're speaking with our senior producer, Nora Barris-Friedman, on the ground in occupied Palestine. She is on the West Bank reporting for about the next month. Nora, as I introduced this story, it was about how Joe Biden, the U.S. Vice President, came to Israel to reassure the Israeli government, nice picture of him shaking hands with the Prime Minister there, that United States is going to stand right next to Israel, given the threat posed now by Iran that might in 10 or 20 or 30 years have nuclear weapons. Your response?
Well, you know, here's the same old story, which is classic when it comes to the United States, of course. The United States, of course, is also a nuclear state. We're the only country in the world that has actually dropped atomic nuclear weapons on another country. And we are a pretty heavy supplier of nuclear fortified weapons, especially to the state of Israel. Israel is the only nation in the Middle East that is not under international scrutiny for its secret nuclear weapons program. We're talking about a country that has over 200 nuclear weapons, and that's just the ones that we know about. They dropped, you know, radioactive materials on Gaza during the siege a year ago. Israel, I mean, it's laughable, but it's also tragic when you think about the immense weaponry and the immense power and the immense support that this rogue nuclear state, Israel, gets from another rogue nuclear state, the United States. And they can talk about Iran's nuclear program until they're blue in the face. But it's still not going to address the fact that, Israel is the country in the Middle East that has a secret nuclear weapons program that needs to be addressed and confronted and challenged right now.
And, of course, Israel was the country that flew over several other countries violating airspace international law to bomb a nuclear reactor in Iraq. This nuclear renegade with over 200 nuclear weapons who arrests and puts into solitary confinement people who protest their program is now considered a logical alternative if the U.S. wants to hit Iran. Everybody continues talking about how it would be fine if Israel bombs Iran. Now, this has got to be the ultimate in contradiction.
Well, yeah, obviously, and you know, but Israel is known for its contradictions, for its hypocrisies, for its double standards. Palestinians here, you know, it's not news to them.
Well, let's be clear, Nora. I just want to be clear. The International Atomic Energy Commission, the association that monitors nuclear weapons, they have never been allowed to come into Israel and inspect nuclear weapons systems or anything like that, correct?
That's correct.
Never.
Exactly.
They
Never.
Are. When we say renegade, this is not hyperbole. They are a nuclear No. renegade that does not pay attention to international law.
Well, that's right. And there are many instances. There are instances every day, every single minute of every day, Israel violates international law, whether it's breaking into a Palestinian's home and taking their 10-year-old child and beating them under the stairwell until they need hospitalization. That's a violation of international law. Whether it's taking people's homes in Bethlehem and Beit Jala and Hebron and Ramallah and Nablus and Jenin and Tulkarm and Qalqilia, taking them, destroying them, destroying their land, uprooting their entire lives and building an illegal apartheid wall, that's against international law. I mean, every single day here, you turn over a stone and you find another violation of international law. This is not news, and it's up to the international community to really, pull themselves up by their bootstraps at this point and take Israel head on.
All right, and finally, just a couple of seconds left. You have been reporting on the arrest of a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old in occupied West Bank, and then the return of the Israeli security forces to beat the living hell out of the 10-year-old. How's he doing now? Do we know?
I think he's doing okay. I haven't had a chance to check in with the family today, but that's the first thing on my agenda tomorrow morning. You know, I've been getting responses from all over the world, from people who have read the story or have listened to the report on Flashpoints and have been completely affected by it, crushed by it, heartbroken by it, and people asking what they can do. And really, you know, we all need to ask ourselves what we can do as taxpayers, as Americans, as people whose governments we elect and try to hold responsible for the support that they give to the Israeli administration. You know, some people are lobbying Congress on behalf of this story. Some people are, you know, talking to organizations that, international organizations that deal with trauma in children. People are doing something about it. But, you know, it's really time that a collective movement come together and really force the eyes open of the international community and the United Nations and the European Union and, of course, the United States. To take a look at what's going on here and not just shake the Palestinian president's hand and say, God, I'm really sorry about those settlement colonies in East Jerusalem, but do something concrete about it. That's what Palestinians here are waiting for. They're waiting for someone to step in and defend them and challenge Israel in court, in an international court of law, because of all these violations of international laws.
Okay, that's the voice of Nora Barros Friedman, senior producer for Flashpoints on the Ground on the occupied West Bank, reporting for all of you on Pacifica Radio, Free Speech, really, People's Radio. Nora Barros Friedman, please be careful. And thanks a lot for all the hard work.
Thanks, Dennis.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are joined by a very good friend, supporter of this show, whose work and thoughts we learn from every Wednesday. Joining us for Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz is Catherine Austin Fitz. Welcome.
Hi, Dennis.
Good to have you back with us. If I had an orchestra and I could do a drum roll, I would have been, you can imagine all of it for you. Welcome back. We didn't have a chance to talk, but I know lots are going on, lots of stuff is going on. And why don't you take the lead?
I've been deeply immersed in reading the H.R. 4173, the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which is only 1,700 pages long.
How long did it take you to start?
Well, I haven't finished. In fact, I have my attorney going it through, and then I'm just going through what, you know, what she comes through, because you literally need, you know, you need many years of legal training and then many years of being my lawyer and becoming deeply suspicious, you know, to find out what's going on in this. But I thought I'd give a little tidbit that relates to your work. You remember that wonderful company, DynCorp?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So you remember...
Now, let's see. Were they the prostitution ring in Bosnia?
They were the company that was sued by two employees for sex slave trafficking, allegations of sex slave trafficking, including, you know, Army CID videotapes of sex slave trafficking by the site managers and leadership of the contracting on site.
Another reputable private contractor. Yes,
well, the
go
thing
on,
that was
please.
Amazing. I don't know if you remember this, Dennis, but I published on my web a copy of a letter from Richard Armitage to Armitage was a very player in the Iran-Contra scandals, but became assistant or deputy secretary of state in the second Bush administration, and writing in his position as a deputy assistant secretary or assistant secretary of state, he was reporting to a congressional committee that DynCorp should not be penalized from getting, you know, gewgaws of more State Department contracts just because a few employees were alleged to be sex slave trafficking. Anyway, I finally wrote an article just collecting up all the different allegations of corruption by DynCorp. DynCorp was also the company running the war on drugs when the plane of missionaries was shot down. It goes on and on. Anyway, so I'm reading the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, and as I'm reading it, and it keeps saying you have to give your data to the SEC, and you have to give this data, and the SEC has the right to demand you give this data. Of course, all the time I'm knowing that the information systems at the SEC the last time I looked were run by DynCorp. So once again we have the Concentration of Cash Flow Act. But you look at the world very differently, and you look at these kinds of legislation very differently when you realize a lot of this is about who controls what data, and the government is paying these companies to literally own and control all this data. And frightening today, I don't know if you've seen this, we now have discussions of Congress of requiring all employers to require their employees to have RFID chipped ID cards on the theory that this will somehow stop illegal immigration.
You know, I missed that one.
That one's new. Senator Schumer has been proposing and promoting this. We did have Senator McCain, however, back down, pressured by Senator Hatch, and Senator Hatch reported that Senator McCain has backed down from sponsoring a bill that would essentially outlaw vitamins.
Well, here's the thing, Catherine. There is so much going on, and it is most people are confounded by what is happening. I can't. It is confusing to me, and I try and pay attention. But if I were to say to you, you know, sort of evaluate the percentage of good news and bad news about the economy, everywhere I listen, it's always about 80% good, and then there's one bad thing, and the bad thing is jobs.
Right. Right. What you're hearing is good news for corporations, bad news for people. That's pretty much what you're hearing.
And how can you predict, how can you evaluate whether we're still going to be troubled by so many people struggling and so many people out of work? Can we say Bernanke says 2 years. 2 years and we'll be back on track. 2 years for what? What's going to happen in 2 years?
Well, if you look at what's going on now, pretty much all the actions we're taking, Dennis, it's a little bit like a body on steroids, and we keep giving the body more steroids, and so the body keeps getting weaker. And, who was it who said, what is relevant is what solves the problem. If we thought through real relevancy, we'd be on Sirius today. It was Sir Peter Medawar. And the reality is, we keep centralizing the economy, we keep centralizing economic and political control, and that keeps shrinking the health of the economy. So, you know, we keep moving the blood to the toes and the fingers away from the heart and lungs. And all solutions begin with decentralizing the economic and political power in a way that will allow us to build new wealth. And that's what we've been talking about, you know, on Community Business every week since we started this. I went to one of the most wonderful speeches I've ever heard this Saturday night. It was at Tennesseans for Liberty is a group in based in Jackson, Tennessee. Wonderful group of people, very much focused on running for local office and running for state office and really rebuilding local economies. And the person, Franklin Sanders, spoke, and he has a farm, Top of the World Farm in Middle Tennessee. And one of the things he mentioned was how many dairy farms had been put out of business in Tennessee because of the requirements for pasteurization. He's been lobbying to get a raw milk bill passed where farmers can sell raw milk to people who want to buy it. And what he pointed out was if this legislation was passed and the rules that had been created revoked, you know, quote-unquote food safety, one farmer with 7 to 8 cows could generate $90,000 of revenues. The average food purchases for a household, for a person, is about $1,800 a year, I think. And so in a county of 100,000 people, that's $180 million. And, of course, we're centralizing that all into, you know, Monsanto and the big corporations. And that's thousands of little farms and small businesses that are wiped out. And one of the quickest ways we could revitalize our local economies is to just reverse those rules. In Tennessee, you're not allowed to process any chickens on the farm, whereas over in Alabama, you can do 20,000 a small farmer. So, you know, and revitalizing local economies are thousands of little things like that. Thousands and thousands of rules. You know, many of them done in the name of safety that have literally forced, whether it's the capital or the purchases or the bank deposits, into these centralized organizations. So it's really about getting into the nuts and bolts of what it takes to decentralize the economy in your place, because the opportunities are many, but it is going to take organization, and that organization will happen because people get frustrated. I just saw Rasmussen Reports did a poll last week and reported that now 75% of Americans say that they are angry about government policies, and 45% say they are very angry. And, Dennis, this is coming into the congressional elections, and if the Democrats continue to push health care in the sort of current construct, I think we're going to see that 75% go over. You know, go over 80, which is the tipping point, and who knows what could happen to that 45%. But I think this year's elections, both at a state and congressional level, will be very interesting.
Oh, yes, they will. Really, we'll learn a lot more about the real nature of the bailout policy, which have many people still reeling and trying to untangle the confusion of what happened. Let me ask you what your concerns are now if we proceed apace, current policy, current monetary policy, printing the money. What do you see next? What
well,
kinds of
America,
signs?
Well, America's going to head into a very slow-motion version of what Argentina and Latin America and some of these other countries have gone through, because, you know, we haven't done anything to address the health of our local economies. What we're doing is we're using monetary policy to drain wealth and a variety of other things, you know, basically engineering government money in certain ways to drain wealth. And unless you reverse that, Dennis, we're going to keep draining. You know, people's incomes are going to keep falling. We see announcements that there are increases in employment, and that's just not the case. What we have is a huge bulge of temporary workers hired to do the census. And, you know, so I don't think there's any fundamental improvement in employment. So we're just going to keep seeing income drop. And what needs to happen is a political, people literally come together start to take those actions that are going to be necessary to change it. Otherwise, we're headed on a perpetual, you know, hamster on a wheel kind of drain.
All right. We're going to start taking calls here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We don't do that often. We've got Doug on Flashpoints for you, Catherine. Doug.
Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Doug.
I want to find out. First of all, I agree with your analysis. I think that economically we're definitely in a huge problem. The health care bill that Obama's team is pushing is a disaster and will definitely hurt the Democrats much more than not. And these are all problems, problems, problems. What can we do about them?
Because here's what we can do.
I'm going to throw something at you, and I want to see what your reaction is.
Okay.
What about a general strike for health care and jobs? Jobs along the lines of the WPA program that some local educators like Gray Brecken have talked about, how very successful it was in getting people back to work. But is a general strike something that you think might be a possibility now?
All right. Thank you, caller. Great question.
I would say a general strike, but I would say a general financial strike. In other words, one of my favorite lines from the old TV show Dallas was when Shock said to Bobby, "Nobody gives you power, you take it." And I think we need to stop thinking in terms of asking government for things and withdrawing our support. So, you know, if any general strike needs to be discussed, it's on April 15th, everybody files extensions and then has this conversation with the leadership in their local area about whether or not it's time for, you know, federal taxes to be escrowed with the local government until and unless the federal government starts to comply with their laws related to financial management. But whether it's deposits, donations, investments, all the areas of our money, we need to withdraw our money from the big corporations and address whether we're going to continue to pay taxes to a government if it's not going to comply with the laws related to expenditures and investment of those funds. So I think a strike is the right concept, but I think we need to get deeply into the money.
David, you are on Pacifica Radio with Catherine Austin Fitz.
Thank you. Ms. Fitz, just the word black market, as people define what's legal and illegal, I know, like, you know, the concept of you can't hold seed and, you know, is a law worth following that's outrageous. I know you have a precept about you don't like to do anything illegal. Have you ever seen any benefits of what black markets are, and are they truly free markets?
Well, it gets very granular very quickly. I mean, there's some black markets that to me are perfectly make sense. There are others that don't. But, you know, what I would really encourage you to do is go online and look at the 10th Amendment Center, because there are lots of laws being passed at the federal level which are not constitutional. And what is happening, we just saw Virginia pass a law saying no one in Virginia had to comply essentially with federal health care mandates that come down from the health care reform. And I think you're going to start seeing more and more states passing laws saying, you know, within this state we don't have to comply with that law because it's a violation of the 10th Amendment. And you know, and we've seen very strong Supreme Court cases on point supporting the state's rights underneath the 10th Amendment. So for a black market to get very meaningful, it's really going to have to come under the auspices of the state and local governments turning around and saying, no, you know, you, the federal government, do not have the authority to do that, to require that, and we're not going to, you know, we're going to stand up to that.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Catherine Austin Fitz. She's a former Wall Street banker, a former high-level official in the first Bush administration. She was an assistant secretary of housing and has gone through so many both difficult and wonderful transformations, and she is our translator from Main Street to Wall Street and whatever street you look or live on. Here is Janice. You're on with Catherine Austin Fitz.
Hello. You mentioned financial strike. I would like to know if there's a way I work for a multinational corporation, and I have a 401k plan. I'll be 62 in July, and I'm wondering if there's any way that I can get that money out of there without having a big tax penalty.
Only, you know, when you leave the company, you can convert to a private plan, and you then have much more flexibility. You know, I'm assuming that your plan, probably you can't do anything with it unless you take it out and pay taxes before you leave the company. But when you do leave the company, you know, you'll have far more flexibility. You can convert it to a private plan and then do a lot with it.
All right. And, of course, I want to be careful that the idea here is that it's not a personal advice show. We're talking in broad swaths about the economy, about economics, about systems, and focusing sort of on the big picture, even if we're focusing at the local level. And we've got Habu on from Madison, Wisconsin. Habu,
okay.
Welcome.
Yes, thank you so very much for taking my call. And it's always nice to hear your sage advice, Ms. Austin Fitz. I've also heard you on Max Kaiser. But this is what I have a slight problem with your angle, and maybe even semantic. You know, Iceland, they completely rebuked the referendum.
Wasn't that wonderful?
Yeah, and that was, you know what, 93.2% against it. And uh-huh. Only 1.8. Imagine, you know, they say 2. It's actually 1.8. That ought to ring some bells somewhere. But, you know, here's where my disagreement or perceived uh-huh. disagreement comes with you. You know, you also said, you know, financial strike. You kind of, underscored financial. I mean, why is it that Americans, and I'm not talking about blood in the streets, but why is it Americans can't go and say, enough of this trade policy? We need to bring jobs back, and instead of kind of deciding around what they give us, and which is nothing anymore, and then we say, okay, well, I've got to have my own chickens at home, or I've got to do this within my home. I mean, it's almost like we are downgrading our expectations.
Well,
as they keep tightening the screws. But thank you.
No,
so
but
very much.
I think I agree with you because I think we need to not ask government to give us jobs. We need to stop government from stealing our jobs and destroying our jobs. So I think a general strike that stops government from destroying the economy is an excellent idea, whether it's taxation or doing those things that destroy businesses here. So I think we need to stop government, but we don't need to ask government to give us anything. We're perfectly capable of creating the economy and jobs without government. We need government to stop doing harm. Anyway, so I'm for less government, not more. I'm for government getting out of our hair.
And now we've got Bill joining us from San Francisco, California. You're on with Captain Austin Fitz.
Yes, howdy. I was a couple of things. One, it seems like one thing that's been going on, it seems like they've been offering us, they're taking us our money for a product they haven't even given us, our money from the future, and we're not even being offered anything at this point, which is a very interesting way of conducting business. But secondly, also, I'm very curious as to why there's not more dissension amongst the capital class. I mean, because not all of them are in with the investment bankers. And how come there's not more dissension amongst within the ruling class with what's going on right now?
Thank you, Bill.
Those are excellent questions. I think people in the ruling class are scared. I think because there is so much violence and, you know, just for safety reasons, I'll use my own story. But if you study what happened to me, I lived through very significant physical harassment and surveillance, you know, 12 plus years of litigation, which cost $6 million in legal fees. You know, the people who are running things don't play they don't play fair and they don't follow the law. And we've reached a point where things are very, very dangerous. And so I think there are a lot of people in the capital class who are looking for a way out. And one of the great opportunities is if the people who in the capital class can find ways of organizing with broad-based networks who really do believe in a much more democratic and bottom-up and decentralized world, there's tremendous opportunity, and that's why it's so important that we create a shared model of how we can build up communities and build up a democratic form of capitalism, which is a healthy and fair place for private capital. One of the things that keeps the capital class very much locked into the system is a belief that they're responsible for, say, in America, at least $15 trillion of retirement savings, and globally many, many more trillions, and they don't see a way to shift that capital into a much more democratic vision that will respect that capital. And if we can really create an investment model that's based in decentralized networks and sort of democratic globalization, then I think we're going to see more and more of the members of the capital class sort of joining us, you know, and creating a new way. Because it's there to be done, and that's the way that can create the most wealth. The centralization model shrinks wealth, and we really need one that builds wealth and builds democracy at the same time, because it's human freedom that unleashes the entrepreneurial spirit that has traditionally always created real wealth.
All right, Mark, you are on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio with Catherine Austin Fitz.
Hi. First of all, to Dennis, I love hearing you fundraise, and I think you're the best out of the KTSA. The other shows should hire you to do it for them.
That is my nightmare. I have terrible, terrible dreams. It is over, but welcome. Thank you.
And regarding your guest, I'm a little dismayed regarding sort of an interesting mix of what I would consider kind of left-leaning, you know, decentralization and democracy sort of framing with very sort of right-leaning framing with regards to, you know, less regulation and specifically the comments regarding healthcare reform. And I was wondering if she could comment on whether it was the lack of a viable single-payer option, which is...
All right,
sort of,
sum it up because we have a minute and I wanted to respond.
So is the main option lack of single-payer and also being angry at government policies is very general.
All right, we have a minute. Go, Catherine.
I think more government control of our health care and our health care data and interference in the medical system is going to produce more trouble, more invasion. It's going to be... I was a little girl when my father, who was a very successful surgeon, came home and said, let the government into medicine and we're going to destroy it, and he was right. And I think the health care that's being proposed, unfortunately, is going to make it much worse. And the real solutions to health care are not even on the table, like a radical cut in costs and other things. Before we close, Dennis, I wanted to mention two things that every person on this call might consider doing.
30 seconds.
One is look into permaculture if you haven't discovered the magic of what can happen when we get our natural ecosystems realigned with our financial ecosystems. I really encourage you to do that. And the other is if you care about any election this year, you want to look into who's going to be your sheriff. If the local sheriff has the power to stop the feds. Any law that's
support
unconstitutional
your local sheriff. We're out of time. Solari.com/blog for more with Catherine Weston Fitz. Catherine, eternally indebted. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you are, we're out of here. That's it.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.